Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle's dedicated weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
On the west side of the road is a typical high-rise block, and that's what was envisaged was going to happen on the site of Alexandra Road. That's what the planners thought would be built here.
As growing cities mull over how to provide enough homes for burgeoning populations, we look to an iconic 1970s project that still speaks of the confidence of the post-war building boom. We tour London's Alexandra Road estate with the man who spent a decade penning a book to celebrate it. We also take tea with one of the folks who calls it home.
When I look back, and I've got some lovely photos, which I'll show you later, it was lovely. It was a rainbow community.
Plus a hidden enclave in Amsterdam, and how would you solve the capital's housing crisis if you were the mayor of London? I put the question to one of the directors at Practice, Levitt Bernstein. All that coming up right here in the next half hour in Section D.
In terms of building high density schemes within cities, I'm a real believer in a high density medium rise solution for sites. I think there are moments of opportunity for height across cities, but that has to be coordinated, it has to be strategic. You have to think about how high buildings relate to each other.
Some food for thought there from Joe McCafferty, a director at London-based Practice Levitt Bernstein. We'll hear a little more from Joe later on. But first, home to 1,600 people and built on a site the size of 12 football pitches, the Alexandra and Ainsworth estate in the London borough of Camden was built in 1978, designed by social housing pioneer Neave Brown, who sadly passed away this January.
We were working then not to do social housing, but to do housing. Not to do a site, but to work on the idea of a piece of city.
The estate's brutalist architecture and gritty concrete charms have provided a backdrop for everything from fashion shoots to films. Now, in a new book that was 10 years in the making, historian and architecture critic Mark Swenerton chronicles the ambitious scheme in all its glory. Monocle's own Daphne Karnesis went to meet Mark Swenerton on site at the Alexandra Road estate to find out firsthand what lessons can be learned from this modernist marvel. Daphne started by asking how the estate went against the grain of the other housing projects of its era.
On the west side of the road is a typical high-rise block, the sort that was being built by local authorities through the 50s and into the 60s. This is, I think, 17 stories high. And that's what was envisaged was going to happen on the site of Alexandra Road. That's what the planners thought would be built here. But Neave Brown had very different ideas because he had realised that you don't need to build high in order to achieve the densities that are required, that is, to get the number of people or the number of dwellings onto the site. And he had a very different idea, which was about integrating the housing with the surrounding city. And so Rowley Way, which is the central street in Alexandra Road, where we're standing, links with Abbey Road, which is a totally, you know, traditional London street, in a seamless way. And so we can enter into Alexandra Road, into the project, along Rowley Way, just as if we were going down any other road of anywhere else. But of course there is a difference, which is that Rowley Way is a pedestrianised street. In keeping with the requirements of those days, pedestrians and vehicles were separated, so vehicles are at a lower level. And we have this beautiful red-paved pedestrian street curving way into the distance. This is 500 plus units, plus a park, shops, workshops, school. You know, these were not projects that you would come across readily elsewhere.
It's a very simple idea, in a way, and I think that's the beauty of it. Do you feel that when we think about housing projects nowadays, when there are all sorts of limitations and complexities, do you think that we've lost some of that simplicity in the way that we design housing projects and think about housing?
Well, I think a lot of the simplicity here is achieved simplicity rather than inherent simplicity. Because as we look along here, we've got all these staircases leading to front doors. And, you know, front doors on streets was a fundamental part of Neave Brown's concept. But that wasn't easily achieved. And it looked simple, but it took, you know, weeks and months of work in order to achieve that. But I think where you are right is that the basic proposition that we have here is a simple one, which is that you should have streets like you have in any ordinary city, and you should have front doors opening onto those streets, and that the houses or the flats should have their own private external space which is open to the sky, so it's not just like a balcony with another balcony above it. And I think that's part of the culture of London. It's part of the urban tradition of London. You know, that's a simple idea, but it needs quite a lot of work to marry that with specific requirements about density, costs, space standards, etc., etc. At one point, Neave Brown described it as a vast open-air play space, because he had a really powerful empathy with kids. I think in a lot of ways he was still a child at heart. And he really felt the way in which children make games and make play out of all sorts of unexpected things. So where we're standing now, we're looking into the park and we can see two of the official playgrounds, if you like, with swings and all that kind of play equipment. But there's just the whole place is full of things that children play with. And in fact, we saw the kids down there in the pub site, but also here outside the community centre, we've got these steps going up to it, and next to it we've got this quite steep ramp. It must be about 45 degrees, made out of stone. But the kids often come out here, and I said, the kids just love that. You know, they think of all sorts of games to play with it, and it's, you know, endless kind of opportunities for hide and seek. And just, it's like,
I was going to say, hide and seek would be great here. Yeah,
it's like a kind of magic place.
Do people that are designing and building such projects now really care that much?
Well, I think they care, but they don't necessarily get the opportunity to put that into practice, because one of the advantages that the architects had here is that they were employed by the council and the council was building it. And so from that point of view, there was a kind of seamless connection between the design team and the client. Whereas now, if you're an architect and you're working on a housing project, it's quite likely that there'll be a project manager who's above you in the pecking order, and you talk to the project manager about your architectural concept, and that may not carry as much weight as it should do. It may just be down to questions of finance. So I think from that point of view, it was a privileged time that these architects were working in. Okay, well, I think what would be nice before we finish would be to go into one of these houses, because housing is not just about what it looks like from the outside, you know, it's what it's like inside. And fortunately, I've spoken to one of the people who lives here, Elizabeth, and she, in fact, has lived here from the off.
Should we go in?
Yep, let's do it.
I was on the housing list and I was offered this place, and they asked me, and I think they still ask people that, or at least lots of people do reject coming here, do you mind living on a big estate? And I just said, well, you know, just let me go and see. So along I went. When I saw it, I was just amazed. I had no idea that it was even here. And it was very, very white and very pristine and very kind of a bit alien, really.
I guess very different from anywhere you'd lived before.
Oh, completely different, yeah. I'd never lived in a place like this. And I'd heard that they had balconies, and I could see that they had balconies. But when I opened my door, I think that I got number 13 because it was number 13, and it was the only one that was empty, you know? And I think people had avoided it, you know? But for me, it's been pretty lucky, really. Anyway, when I opened the door, because I didn't realise it was downstairs was upstairs and the other way around, I thought, oh dear, I've got one without the balcony. But never mind, never mind, it's nice, you know. So I went downstairs and I looked around the bedrooms and everything. I thought, it's nice anyway, I'm going to have it, you know, it's going to be a great home. And then I went upstairs and I saw my balcony, and I just realised, oh yes, they all have an open space, you know, which is just amazing. When I look back, and I've got some lovely photos, which I'll show you later, I realise it was lovely. It was a rainbow community. There was a real mix of people, you know, and people were not partitioned or segregated. There was a real mix of people. Not that it was completely hunky-dory, but looking back on it, there was a great mix, you know, and things have changed, just like London has changed. As for myself, I mean, I don't think when I first moved here, I was very, very involved because I was just too busy at work and bringing up my son. But the park was my baby, really, and we did do the Heritage Lottery Fund restoration of the park, which was opened about 3 years ago under Parks for People Heritage Lottery Fund, and that's been very, very successful. And that actually took about 4 years of very hard work. And I am the chair of Friends of Alexandra Road Park, and so keep a good eye on it.
Our very special thanks to Monocle's Daphne Karnesis there, speaking to the historian and architecture critic Mark Swennerton, and Elizabeth, one of the original residents of the Alexandra Road estate. Mark's book, Cook's Camden, The Making of Modernist Housing, is published by Lund Humphreys and available now. Now let's hear a little more from Joe McCafferty, a director at the London practice Levitt Bernstein, who specialises in making livable housing and is based in a city struggling to meet high demands for new homes. She joined me in studio to talk about the history of social housing right here in the UK. I asked Jo who's getting it right, and perhaps unfairly, what she would do if I appointed her Mayor of London.
The practice Levitt Bernstein were founded by David Levitt and David Bernstein, who met actually working for Patrick Hodgkinson on the wonderful Brunswick Centre. And at that time, there was yet another housing crisis, and the Ken Loach film Kathy Gum Home had just been released.
So this is the late 60s.
This is the late 1968. And it was a point in time where there were lots of discussions around social housing and the quality of housing and housing provision and how affordable it was. And it was really off the back of the post-war era of Homes for Heroes and mass housing across the UK, and particularly in London on bomb-damaged sites. And I think there was a real focus on the quality of housing and people being interested in engaging with the design of housing. So, for example, the AA, the Architectural Association, a lot of people studying at the school there were designing and looking at projects to do with housing and sort of the social benefits of good housing. So it was happening at the educational level, and it was happening in practice. And of course, at that time too, there was funding for housing, state funding for social housing projects. The population too, across the land, more people lived in social housing and saw it as an everyday occurrence rather than now, where a minority of people actually live in affordable housing.
I'd love to know if you know the numbers for that. Did you say before the interview that roughly 40% of people are living in social housing, and today it's...
That's right. Well, it's now under 10%. So a really big drop. And so it was much more just the fabric of the city. And there was funding behind it. There were inventive, interested architects in designing it. And there were amazing commissioning clients working for local authorities. So it was a very different moment in time. And sort of reflecting back on that now and thinking about how that's changed, obviously through the Thatcher era and through Right to Buy, there has been a sort of a stripping away of the social side of housing provision. And a lot of people bought their own homes, and there's absolutely nothing wrong in that in terms of people buying on estates for a reduced price. However, at the same time, new homes weren't being built that were affordable. So there was this complete undermining of the state funding of housing structure, and then the handing over that process to the private developer. So after Thatcher and during the end of her era, there were lots of private-public partnerships happening where actually the majority of affordable housing was being delivered by the private sector, and that's still true now. So there has been a massive change in the last 50 years in terms of how housing is funded, how people view it, who's engaged with it, both in designing it and commissioning it. And what's interesting now, and even just this year, there are lights at the end of the tunnel, I think, in terms of coming back to a better position in terms of what we design, how it's funded, and how we view social housing.
But actually, when it comes to social housing, a lot of ground was covered in the mid-century, and there are certain practitioners right here in London that probably had some lessons that are worth heeding, aren't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one who has been very much in the public eye in a wonderful way in the last 6 months is Neave Brown. So when Neave was working for Camden under Sidney Cook, he was designing incredibly inventive housing across the borough. And it sort of spanned from his first development to terrace of five houses, one of which I'm very lucky to live in.
I was going to say, you've got personal experience of the wonderful work of Mead Brown.
I certainly do. And the amazing thing is that actually he used that terrace of five houses to test out lots of ideas in terms of the detail of how a balustrade might work, how a window might open, how a threshold might be handled from the public realm into a home, how a home should be organised. And those sorts of lessons, I think he then went on to apply at Dunbourne Road, and then after that at Alexandra Road on a much bigger scale for 520 homes. And I think the lesson I would take from that, and I sort of live the joy of it every day, is just looking at the detail. So really, really thinking about in a home every single millimetre. And I think it's very difficult to do that when you're designing a large housing project, but it's absolutely crucial to the success of it. And he manages to organise the home so cleverly that actually there is a huge amount of privacy. It's incredibly tight in terms of how the spaces are organised, but they feel generous, they feel light-filled, they're flexible. And he works that sort of detail in terms of how it feels as an individual to live in a home and giving that person privacy, and then how those homes work together as a collective successfully. And I think those are the lessons that we can learn. And in all his schemes, he designed spaces with sliding screens, with integrated storage, really looking at the minutiae of how a household might work, thinking about minimising circulation space and maximising the space in habitable rooms, making sure as many homes were dual aspect, so light from both sides, so they could be cross-ventilated. All those wonderful things he got right.
I'm very impressed with the talk of participatory design, of not kind of imposing a view of what you think it should look like over the people that will actually end up using it. But Sam, given the power to make you Mayor of London, and with all of these problems of density and of cost in mind, what would you change to change what is currently described as a housing crisis into the UK into something that was a little bit fairer and gave more homes and more of the kind of homes that people would want and would want to live in? What would you do?
It's a very easy answer to that question because I've been thinking about it a lot.
Running for mayor?
No. What I would do if I were. First of all, I think Sadiq Khan is doing an amazing job at the moment. If we would get under the skin of that, he's just released the draft London plan, which has an enormous amount in it. And we've just fed back our consultation responses into it. And it talks about quality for the first time in housing. It talks about opening up sites for all sorts of different community groups. It has lots of positive things in there. It talks about 50% affordable housing on state-owned sites for the first time in many, many years. So there are lots of good things that are happening that hopefully will fall into policy very, very soon. But alongside, the key thing that isn't spoken about at the moment is money. And there is no real depth of thinking in terms of how to fund housing in terms of social housing and support local authorities to deliver it. So the one thing I would do overnight, I would put much more money into local authorities, not only into funding housing projects and getting those off the ground and support them, unlocking things like their borrowing cap so that local authorities can borrow more money to build it, so it's not all just coming from the government. I also would very quickly make sure that there was a skills pool fed into local authorities so that there are more people working in local authority that can discharge planning consents, that understand how to manage buildings. Maybe more architects working in local authorities would be a good thing, and urban designers and so on. So I think I would reskill local authorities to deliver it.
Our sincere thanks there to Joe McCafferty, a director at London-based Levitt Bernstein. In Amsterdam, social housing was given an early boost thanks to the Amsterdam School, an ambitious cadre of architects working in the international expressionist style in the early years of the 20th century. The period heralded the construction of mass housing in a distinctive and decorative style, usually made from brick and with delicate masonry that adorned the buildings inside and out. Some of the most breathtaking examples are found in the Spaandammer Burt neighbourhood to the west of the city, to where Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey headed for this report.
For the last few months, I've been living in Spaandammer Burt, a little visited part of Amsterdam that on first glance looks ordinary, but on closer inspection is bursting with secrets. Like Zaanhof, a strip of garden enclosed by fairy tale-like terraced houses, complete with turrets and a yolk-yellow trim on all the windows. Or Spaandammer Plantsoen, a square where doorways have been turned into works of art thanks to their unusual design. But the crowning glory of this neighbourhood is Het Schip, the ship, a truly magical triangular building that boasts unexpected curved windows, undulating sections of brick wall, and a large red tile tower. This is truly a shining example of brick expressionism. All of this was built a century ago as social housing for the exploding number of working class families created by the Industrial Revolution. The architects behind the area were part of the Amsterdam School movement.
Architects wouldn't like to build for the worker at all. In general, they want to build villas and churches. But architects who choose to build for the workers were convinced of the fact that they should do it very nice. Because otherwise, why should you do it otherwise? So that was the beginning of the social housing. And they really wanted to make a statement. And the biggest statement is made here, Michel de Klerk, that is worldwide famous.
That's Alice Roekholt. And here is Het Schip, part of which has been turned into a museum on the Amsterdam School Movement, where she is director. As more and more people came to Amsterdam to work, many parts of the city became cramped, dirty slums. The Housing Act of 1901 was passed to create better low-income mass housing, she explains, and the Spaarendammerbuurt was earmarked as one of the areas to realise this dream. Housing associations quickly formed, and each commissioned a different architect for their plot of land. The idea was for people with similar beliefs to live together in equality. It was a socialist project, reflected in the choice of red brick, but with a twist.
The very special thing is that the artist, Michel de Klerk, thought, well, the people are all equal because they have equal thought about the future and the life, but everybody has its own special house. So one has a triangle window and another has a balcony. Everybody has something what another doesn't have. So he created room in the political sense for the individual. So it was not a mass thinking. So everybody's the same. So you get the same, no? Everybody a little different.
But more than just preserving individualism, de Klerk and his fellow Amsterdam School Movement architects were out to do something even more ambitious and controversial for their time. Provide the working man with beauty. They even designed wonderful furniture for inside the homes.
Yes, that's really true. And he also said nothing is beautiful enough for the worker who had lived so long without any beautiness. And it was a kind of idea here in Holland among the Social Democrats. Beautiness will help us to make a better life in general. So these people thought, well, when we make a beautiful environment, people will become better. So that is a very special thing in time what happened.
For the hard-working but impoverished residents who toiled away in the nearby port and factories, the effect of living in something so undeniably special, something designed just for them, must have been uplifting. The area became known as the Palace of the Working Man. Even today, people in the area talk about the pleasure they get from just looking out the window or strolling down the street. Art Roelofsmaar has lived opposite Het Schip for more than 30 years.
It's one of the nicest streets here in the neighbourhood, and I'm very glad I'm living here.
How does it make you feel when you look at it? What does it make you think?
Oh, always happy. I like the style, the Amsterdam school style.
What do you like about it?
The shapes, the way they use brick stones and can manage to give it a natural feel, a natural look. It's a bit half of what Gaudi does, and that's the most beautiful part about it. And it's original. They always use original shapes, which you don't expect. And I really think this is one of the most beautiful examples of it.
He takes me out onto the street to show me his favourite place to sit outside with a friend and a beer, the Spaarendammer Plantsoen. Centred around a large park with playgrounds and benches, the square's sweeping brick facades with their quirky details make the space feel both imposing and playful.
In fact, this is called the purple block because of the colour of the brickstones that they used. It has some very odd details. What's the thought about the bricks that are running out of the walls? As if they didn't take the initiative to move the parts standing out. But they just used it as kind of making it looking nice.
This desire to create beauty is sorely lacking from most social housing projects today, including in the Netherlands. But as housing pressures in big cities continue to grow, such initiatives are getting their turn in the spotlight again. With a bit of creativity and investment, who knows where the next Amsterdam School movement will emerge. For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Our special thanks to Monocle's correspondent in Amsterdam, Venetia Rainey. Next week, we talk about the subtle skill of selling tickets with cannily conceived theatrical posters, plus a roundup of the design magazines worth sitting down with. Section D was produced by Daphne Karnesis, researched by Pierre-Antoine Denis, and edited by Christy Evans. We'll leave you now with Make the World Go Away by Eddie Arnold, a song that was playing when we visited Elizabeth's flat in Block C of the Alexandra Road estate. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Make the world go away. Do you remember?